Yeah, that's I am. Hey, let's go ahead and turn in our Bibles to Daniel chapter 3. Title of our study this evening, In the Fire with Jesus. Daniel 3, In the Fire with Jesus. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather the satraps and administrators, the governors and the counselors, the treasurers, the magistrates, or the judges, the magistrates, all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace." So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp and lyre and symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, if you weren't here last time, in Daniel 2, we saw this great and glorious image, and we saw that the image was given to Nebuchadnezzar in a dream, and it was meant to give him a picture of prophetic history. And so what happens is, well, when Daniel interprets the dream for him, he says, "You are this head of gold. God has given you a kingdom, and everywhere you rule and reign, you're the head of gold." But he says, "After you," because there's always an after. I mean, nobody lives forever. And he's saying, "After your kingdom will be another kingdom, inferior to yours." I'm sure Nebuchadnezzar liked that. At least, well, if there's got to be someone else, at least it won't be as great as mine. But that we saw would be the Medo-Persian. So we have the Babylonian kingdom under Nebuchadnezzar. Then we have the Medes and the Persians. And we made mention, Babylon is where Iraq, Medo-Persian Empire is there in Iran, and then there would be the Grecian, and then there would be the Roman, and that was divided into two sections. There would be the Roman Empire that would rule in Jesus' day, then there would be a revival of that empire in the latter days, as we talked about the 10 toes and connected it to the 10 kings who rule all at the same time together, and we looked at a bit of Revelation. We'll do that again tonight. Because the book of Daniel is really giving us in prophecy and in picture just a glorious microcosm of what actually takes place in the book of Revelation. Well, in any case, this building of a golden image, and get it, 90 feet by 9 feet. It wouldn't have been solid gold. You can't make anything out of solid gold and have it stand up that high. But whatever it was plated in gold, and 90 feet tall. I don't know if you can even begin to imagine. This building, I think, is somewhere around 24 feet tall. It's pretty tall. So, I mean, you imagine, you see this cross, that's probably only about 18 feet high. So you're going to go, really, 8 stories high to get this big. And so what's he doing? He's making this great and glorious image, and in doing so, he is denying two things. First of all, God's sovereignty. Because God said, "You're the head of gold," through Daniel, and he makes the whole image out of gold. And basically, the four kingdoms were represented in the four parts of the image. The head, and then the chest and arms, and then the, you know, midriff, and then down to the feet and legs. And so what he's doing is he's denying God's sovereignty, and he's denying the prophecy and the interpretation of the prophecy. Now, I'm one of those guys that when I come across a word that seems significant, like image, I like to go back to the first place that image or that word appears. And in this case, the word image appears the first time in Genesis 1:26, where God says, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness." It's the first clue, by the way, that not only were we made like God and to be like God, but that God is, though, one God, three persons, because, you know, you just don't talk to yourself. It would just be, "Let me make man in my image," but it's, "Let us make man in our image." It's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit creating man, not in the physical image of God, but like God in that, well, we have a lot of characteristics unique to us because we were made in the image of God. We have the ability to reason. We have the ability to choose. We have abilities that come to us directly because we were the crown of God's creation. Well, in any case, this word image appears 11 times in Daniel chapter 3. And it's 110 times in the scripture. First mention, already made mention, "Let us make man in our image." And you should remember, when they came testing Jesus, "Do we have to pay taxes?" Probably April 14th or something, you know. And it's like he's like, "Well, show me the coin whose inscription is on it." The coin, of course, bore Caesar's inscription in Jesus' day. And he says, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, to God the things that are God's." Why is that important to us? Because God's image is stamped on us. We are created by Him and for Him. We were created in His image. And though that image has been marred by sin, it's clear that we're to render ourselves to Him. Well, first prohibition against making any image. And of course, this was given to God's people. That's not Nebuchadnezzar. He's a pagan. He's just going to do what he does. But Nate, make note of this, because it will be the reason, the key to why Daniel's friends will not bow down to this image. Well, I didn't want to spoil it for you. If you didn't read ahead, well, there you have it. Might as well take off, eh? Just kidding. You should be reading ahead. But he says in Exodus 20, verse 4, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything in heaven above, or in earth beneath, or in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." Now he's saying, and understand this, if you make them, the end result is you'll bow down to them. That's an act of worship, of homage, and you'll end up serving them. So he just says, here's the way to avoid all that. Don't make them. Don't have images. Don't get into the whole graven image. And of course, an image is an idol. And so for us, it might be better to just say, since most of us aren't sitting at home carving out little images and then, you know, plating them with gold or anything. No, but we can have idols. And he's saying, don't. Because if you have an idol, you're going to bow down to it and you're going to serve it and you're going to give yourself to it. Well, again, back in Daniel 2:31, "You king were watching, behold a great image." This is the first time in Daniel the word appeared. "This great image whose splendor was excellent stood before you and its form was awesome." Now, there's just a couple other things and we'll press on. This image is set up there in Babylon, not far from the original site of the Tower of Babel. I mean, that's why it's called the Tower of Babel. You know that he confused their languages there, but it happened there in the plains there in Babylon. So Babylon is the center of idolatry. It is the place where man first organized a resistance to the revealed will of God. God said, "I want you to disperse and fill the earth and subdue it." And instead, they all got together and said, "Let's just build ourselves this thing that'll take us right up to the heavens." So he's constructing, as it were, his image, and he's his own Babylonian idol. I mean, this whole American idol thing, so, hey, that's our thing. But back then, they had it. He sets his idol up in the same neighborhood where Nimrod first constructed the Tower of Babel, that birthplace of idolatry. Well, the other thing that's mentioned here, and I have to make sure you see it, is that this was all about worship. In fact, 11 times in Daniel chapter 3 and 112 times in the Bible, the word worship appears. And here's what I've learned. When we or anyone fails to worship the true and living God, we're going to end up worshiping someone or something else. Why? Because God created us with a need to worship. Not just with the capacity to do so, but with a driving internal need to express ourselves in worship. Adoration. And so if we don't connect with God and we don't give God His due, we will find ourselves doing what they did, worshiping the gods of our imagination. Gods are us, popular in this generation, the works of their own hand. And God calls that idolatry. Well, first mention, and you don't have to go to it, we've talked about it many times. First time the word worship appears in Scripture, Genesis 22, Abraham and Isaac ascending that mountain. We're going to go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you. So we get a key there that worship involves sacrifice. And what they do here is they say, I want you to all bow down, worship this image. In doing so, you're showing you're submitted to the king, you're submitted to the kingdom, but in doing so, they would be sacrificing the opportunity to worship the true and living God. Well, at that time, we read in verse 8, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Now we're going to see it's three guys they're mainly concerned with and upset at. And here's why. Daniel's friends with Daniel had been exalted there in the kingdom of Babylon. And it's one thing to have some people from Israel serving as slaves in the community, you see. But these guys have been exalted. They've been given positions of responsibility and notoriety. And so the Chaldeans aren't liking that at all. So they're like, Lord, you know, or King, you made this decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. Wow. They actually had a furnace going just in case anybody decided not to bow down to the king. Now, I would suggest if this were a political thing, that that's not really a way to gauge your popularity. Because, of course, I mean, how many people aren't going to bow down if it's, well, let's see, bow down or fiery furnace? For most pagans, it's a no-brainer. If you really want to know, do the people love you? Do they honor you? Do they worship you? You just say, hey, you guys bow down when the band starts. I wonder what would have happened that day if the furnace weren't burning, if the fire wasn't burning. But in any case, it was. And they just say, here's your choices. Bow down and worship, or you're going in to the burning, fiery furnace. Verse 12 says, there's certain Jews who you set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. See, that's the rub. You gave them authority and power and notoriety. Them? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you've set up. And Nebuchadnezzar, in a rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, and psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the image which I have made good. Hey, listen, he's given them a second chance. That's something. As angry as he was, you could tell he liked these guys, and he's saying, hey, listen, it has to be a mistake. I'm going to give you another chance. We're going to kick the band up, and when they get playing, you're going to come on, and you're going to bow down and worship my image. Now, whether it really bore any likeness to him doesn't matter. because it was clearly an act of rebellion on his part. God says, you're the head of gold. He says, I'm the whole thing. God says, you're going to rule for a while. The idea is, I'm going to rule forever. And of course, all that's nonsense. But in any case, he says, if you do not worship, just in case they hadn't really understood the consequences, it's there in verse 15, the latter part, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? That's quite a statement, isn't it? Or quite a question. It reminds me of Pharaoh when Moses came and said, hey, God says, let my people go that they might worship me. And Pharaoh says, hey, I don't know the Lord. And who's he to tell me what to do? I'm not going to do what he says. And I'm paraphrasing a bit, but that's the gist and the heart of what happens there. And you know what goes on. God says, oh, you don't know who I am? Let me show you. And miracle after miracle in the form of judgments that fell on Pharaoh and his people in Egypt demonstrated who God is, his power. And that's really what's going to happen here, except for it's going to be a positive in that it's going to be his ability to preserve and to protect. And we're going to see there's very practical application for those of us who are going through a fiery trial or enduring a season of struggle, or, well, in any case, he says, who's the God who'll deliver you from my hands? By the end of the chapter, he knows, and he'll testify. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be made known to you, O king, we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. And all I can say to that is, wow. Because they're standing there before the most powerful man on the planet. And they're looking at the fiery furnace, and he's saying, here's your choices. You bow down or you're going into the fiery furnace. And I love how they tell him, hey, our God's able, but either way, he'll deliver us from your hands. Either way, yeah, if he protected them and preserved them, that's deliverance. If he even let them die in the fire, either way, they're free from Nebuchadnezzar and going to be with the Lord. And in any case, they do testify to their confidence in God. That either way, whatever happens, we will not serve your gods. We will not worship the gold image which you have set up. Now, take note of this. Nebuchadnezzar, at this point, is consolidating all the government under himself. And he's also consolidating religion under himself. In other words, he's somebody who is both a civil and a religious leader. And he's demanding that everyone acknowledge both. I mean, it's one thing to acknowledge, okay, you're ruling, you're reigning. That's a reality. But to bow down to the image was a religious thing, you see. And that's what they couldn't acknowledge. They were, I'm sure, well ready and able and willing to acknowledge that he was, in fact, ruling over them. God had put them there. He had brought them from Israel to Babylon, and they were serving this guy. But it's the religious aspects. Well, you got to go with me for a moment to Revelation 13. It's a serious preview of coming attractions. And in any case, it all lies ahead, and we're not going to look at all of it, but we're going to race through the first part and spend a little bit of time on the second part. And then in about, 20 weeks or so, we'll be looking at it in some detail. Anyway, in Revelation 13, we're going to see yet another, much like Nebuchadnezzar, this guy also consolidating power, both civilly and religiously. And so it says, I stood on the sand of the sea, I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, on his horns 10 crowns, on his heads a blasphemous name. Now, we're not going to develop this, but if you were with us last time, you know this, 10 horns, 10 crowns, that kind of stuff, that's pointing us to leaders, people who are in power and authority. It's that 10 nations and the 10 heads of those nations that will be ruling and reigning during the time that Antichrist, and that's who we're reading of here, comes to power. The beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth like the mouth of a lion. And take note, the dragon gave him power, latter part of verse 2, his throne and great authority. The dragon, we don't have to wonder. This is a reference to Satan. So it's telling us the one John calls Antichrist, the one that we know is going to rule and reign in the last days, he gets his power from Satan. He gets his throne from Satan. He gets his authority from Satan. Now, don't misunderstand this. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Whatever Satan does, God is allowing. And whatever Antichrist does, God is allowing. And when God decides that's it, well, Satan's done and Antichrist is done. But he is going to come to power this man, and he's going to rule with the authority and power and with the throne given to him by Satan. And then he says, I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. His deadly wound was healed. All the world marveled and followed the beast, and they worshiped the dragon. And that's what Satan's always been after. Check it out, Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28. It's all about worship. That's what he wanted from Eve. That's what he asked for from Jesus. That's the dragon. They worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Now pause with me for just a second. When we talked last time about Daniel 2, we touched on Daniel 7, and we're gonna get into Daniel 7, of course, in a few weeks. And in Daniel 7, God gives Daniel the same scenario historically, the same prophetic historical scenario. But this time, instead of seeing this great and glorious image, he describes the four kingdoms, the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Grecian, the Roman, as four great beasts. And so when he talks about the leaders of these kingdoms, he describes them as beasts. Why? Because they come to seek and destroy and devour and representing the one who gives them power and authority, the one who comes to steal, kill, and destroy. So they say they worship the dragon, they worship the beast. Take note of it. Who is like the beast, they say? Who's able to make war with him? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and was given authority to continue for 42 months. Anybody know how long 42 months is? Hey, very good. 3.5 years. Over and over and over, as you go through the book of Revelation, you're going to find this 3.5 years. Why? It's a 7-year period. The latter part is going to be where all hell breaks loose on earth. So this guy has a time frame. He's only going to be in power for 7 years, and he's going to have ultimate power for 3.5 years. But in any case, they just say he's given authority to continue for 42 months. He opens his mouth in blasphemy against God. He blasphemes his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell on earth. It's granted to him to make war with the saints and overcome them. Authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. You see the parallel? Nebuchadnezzar, same exact scenario and situation. The difference being that Nebuchadnezzar's in the past. And anyone who wants to reduce Daniel or Daniel 3 to mythology or a fable, they do so to their own peril. It's history for us. When it was happening, Daniel and the fellows were experiencing it. They were saying, here's what's coming now and here's what'll follow later. So those prophecies and what we see is that what Nebuchadnezzar was about, well, that's exactly what Antichrist will be about. Well, all authority given to him, all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of the life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Now, let me ask you a question. If you've given your life to the Lord, does that mean your name is in the Lamb's Book of Life? And if you don't know the answer is yes. That means you're never going to worship the Antichrist. Why? You know better. You know that you're only to worship the true and living God. And here's why this is so important. Because long before we're out of here, well, we have opportunity during this time to share with people who really are primed to worship the Antichrist. Even in Israel, when we talked with so many people over there, they're waiting for someone to come to solve their problems politically. And they're willing to acknowledge him spiritually. They're looking for Messiah. And the tragedy is Messiah came and they didn't recognize him. The good news is he's coming again and he'll open their eyes and they will recognize him. But between that coming and his next coming, Antichrist is coming. And that's who we read about here. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, except those whose names have been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And there's a phrase for you, and we'll develop it when we study through Rev 13. Well, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. Now, Antichrist means in place of and against. In other words, if you're anti something, you're against it. But in his case, he's not only against Jesus Christ, he substitutes himself, puts himself in the place of Jesus Christ. He presents himself as a savior. He presents himself as the one who's the solution to mankind's problems. And of course, we know Jesus is the solution. But the world is, as we read, and as we saw in Nebuchadnezzar's day, the world's going to bow down and they're going to worship. In Revelation 13:11, I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb and he spoke like a dragon. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it. And that's actually the earth dwellers, those whose, you know, kingdom and life and hope is here physically, tangibly rooted in the earth. Our home, it's in heaven. That's where we're headed. But in any case, he says he causes them to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed, and he performs great signs. So he makes fire come down from heaven in the sight of men, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs. So last days, you have the Antichrist, you have his false prophet. His goal is to get people to worship the Antichrist. He does it through deception. He deceives through, well, signs that he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast, who was wounded by the sword and lived. Now the parallel should be very clear. We have Nebuchadnezzar's image there in the plains of Babylon. And now we have this image of the beast. And this image will be a little unique as idols go. It tells us that certainly this is yet ahead, and you'll see a couple reasons for it. It says he deceives those who dwell. He make an image to the beast. He was granted to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Now listen, I don't think Nebuchadnezzar's image talked. This image is going to be able to speak. And that just tells us that we're looking at a time where there would be technology available so that a great image could communicate in a way that back in those days, a thing just kind of stood there and you bowed down or you didn't. But in any case, he goes on to say, he causes all, small and great, rich and poor, verse 16, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or their foreheads, that no one may buy or sell except the one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number 666. Now, without getting into all of that or worrying about any of it, I would think, since Revelation 13 is to be taken literally, it's talking about a real Antichrist empowered by a real Satan, promoted by a real false prophet, and there's your unholy trinity, by the way, because all of this is going to go down, shouldn't we be warning people? I mean, shouldn't we be mentioning, hey, in case they come along and say, hey, take a mark. It's a good thing. Everybody's going to do it. Yeah, everybody's going to do it. That's the truth. But not those who know the Lord, not those who know better. Look at Revelation 14, verses 9 through 11, and then we're going to go back because we must. Revelation 14, 9 through 11. A third angel followed them. This is why it is so essential that we grab hold of this reality and warn people about what's coming. Saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength in the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast in his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. Listen, this is so important, and it reminds me that back at the Passover, the first Passover, where they were told to take a lamb and slay the lamb and apply the blood, knowing what was coming would not be enough. Believing that the shed blood applied to the doorposts and lintels of the house could protect your firstborn would have been insufficient to protect your firstborn. You would have had to obey. And when we look at something like this and realize, well, I hope you see it as I do, all of this is really going to happen. And I don't think we're going to be here to see it. I think we're going to have front row seats, but it's going to be up a little higher. And so I think we're going to be looking on. I think we're going to be, you know, cheering on the people of God who stand up, who come to Christ during this tribulation time. But here's my point. Those who take the mark, and there will be many who consider themselves believers, but when the rapture happened, they don't go, not because they were carnal, but because they weren't believers. And then they're going to continue on, and they're going to have opportunity to say no to the mark, but they're going to take the mark, and they're going to justify it by saying, well, I'm a believer. I believe in God. I'm a worshiper of God. I've been going to church my whole life. Listen, Jesus says, in the day when the judgment comes, many will stand before him saying, Lord, Lord, didn't we? And they'll talk about all the wonderful things they did for him and in his name. And he'll say, depart from me, you workers of iniquity or lawlessness. I never knew you. Now, who but someone who thinks they know the Lord would say, Lord, Lord, you know, we've been serving you. We've been working for you. We've been, and, well, here's the whole point. It wouldn't work to say, well, I'm a believer. God wouldn't, you know, judge me for taking a simple mark. That would be like saying, well, I'm a believer. God wouldn't judge me just because I didn't put blood on the doorposts and lintels of my house. No, it's always going to be about obedience to what we know to be true. And though I don't believe we'll be around for this, I believe lots of people we know and interact with will be around for it. And if they know ahead of time, well, at least they have a chance to consider it, to process it. Well, again, the false prophet's ability to make an image that can speak, it's a testimony to the technological advancements of the last day. And it's a denial of Psalm 115, which just says, the idols of the heathen are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they don't speak. This one will. But in general, he's saying, you know, people make idols, they make them like themselves. An idol you make is always less than you. That's just the way it is. You can't make something greater than you. So it's so ironic that anyone would create anything and then worship it. But they have mouths, they don't speak. They have eyes, but they don't hear. Eyes they don't see. Noses they have, but they don't smell. Hands and they don't handle. It's interesting. You ever look at our money? There's like images on that stuff. Or years and years ago, I think it was Chuck Swindoll pointed out that when men first made automobiles, they made them in the very same pattern revealed in Romans chapter 1, where it talks about You know, the images that they make an image after themselves, and then after four-footed beast, and then after creeping things. There's sort of this degeneration, you know. But the very first cars, they were named after the people that made them. And then, you know, later they had the cougar, and you know, they had these ones like beast, and then they had the spider, you know, you get to the creeping things. And it's just interesting to see that even in the 20th century, when men make idols, they still follow a pattern of idolatry that Romans 1 tells us we could expect to see. And that Psalm 115 and Psalm 135 and, well, so many other places show us that there is something else. In Psalm 115, verse 8, it says, "Those who make them are like them." And the idea being, hey, deaf, dumb, and blind when it comes to the things of God. Hands, but not really handling the truth. And feet, but not walking in truth. Mouths, but not uttering the truth. Well, back at the ranch, as we used to say, it's back in, and I don't know why we ever said it. I never lived on a ranch, but Daniel chapter 3, verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar, remember him? This was before we got over there to Revelation. Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. The expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. Now, I think this guy may be overdoing it, but, you know, you can come to your own conclusions. He commanded certain mighty men of valor, and this reminds me, you don't want to work for anybody like this, who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, their other garments. They were cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And because the king's command was urgent, the furnace was exceedingly hot. The flame of the fire killed the men who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego up. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Now, there are 2 possibilities here, and you'll know in a moment, if you don't already, where I land on all this. This was either an angel sent to protect them, or this was an Old Testament appearance of our Lord and Savior Jesus. Well, I titled the message, "In the Fire with Jesus," so you probably have a clue from that. I think this is a Christophany. I think this is Jesus showing up. And if you're unfamiliar with the fact that he does things like that, when God was about to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, many of you are familiar, Abraham got into a negotiation with the Lord. And it says that he stood before the Lord. There were 3 there. 2 angels went down into Sodom. But the words "the Lord," if you look them up, not Elohim, which means gods, or God, and in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's Elohim. But that word sometimes is used of those God gives his authority to. So if it had been Elohim, well, you could have said, well, it could be, you know, a representative. It could be, but here's the deal. It says he stood before the Lord. And if you had an old King James Bible, I'm using a new King James. I love what the old King James did. They made all 4 letters caps when the word Yahweh appeared. And Yahweh, it's YHWH. We really don't know how to pronounce the name of God because there were no vowels. And if you try to say YHWH, well, just go ahead for a minute and entertain yourself. Something strange comes out. You really can't do it, and so they didn't try it. And so YHWH, some thought for a long time it was Jehovah. The problem with that is there's no J in the alphabet, and there is a Y, and so it was Yahweh is likely, but we don't know for sure. But this is what we do know. It says Abraham stood before Yahweh. Now that's pretty important. He came near and said, "Would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? That could have been an angel, except it said Yahweh. Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked. Should the righteous be as the wicked? Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of the whole earth do right? Now let me ask you a question. What angel would be called the judge of the whole earth? And then it says, so the Lord. Again, it's Yahweh. Later, he uses the word Adonai. It's another name for God, but never used of angels. So, the Lord, Yahweh, or YHWH, says, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, I will spare all the place for their sakes. There's an application of this. We don't have to work our way down to where it ends up. God is sparing, I believe, our nation and our world at this point for the sake of the righteous who are here. But as he would take righteous Lot, and who would have thunk that, but as he would take righteous Lot and his family out of Sodom before the destruction of Sodom, so he will take us out of here before he passes judgment on a Christ-rejecting world. There's another great illustration of this, and there are a lot of these, by the way. When Joshua is getting ready to take Jericho, he lifts his eyes and it says a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn. And by the way, that first was in Genesis 18:22, if you're a note taker. This one's in Joshua 5:13. Joshua goes to him and says, are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I've come out. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. Now, you know, that's no angel. First of all, he receives the worship. And then he says the very same thing that was spoken to Moses when Moses went up to get the Ten Commandments. Well, I share those with you because I don't want you to take my word for something or just say, well, it must be true, pastor says it. Well, I don't think that any of us are ever charged to just say, well, if he says it, must be right. No, we're all supposed to study and show ourselves approved unto God, workmen that need not be ashamed. We're supposed to be like the Bereans, who were told were more noble than those in Thessalonica, and that they received the word with readiness of mind and then searched the scriptures daily to see if those things were so. And I think you'll find them to be so. I'm not really saying don't trust me. I'm just saying confirm it. So that when you stand before God, if anything's mixed up, you're not going to get to blame it on me. He might hold me accountable for what I said and did, but you're going to pay for what you believed and did and said. So anyway, all that to say, there is one other thing. While God wasn't responsible for this trial, he was allowing it and will use it. In my study of the Psalms today, because I'm doing the Psalms, it's the 6, so we had Psalm 6, Psalm 36, Psalm 66, and in verse 8 I read, and I liked how timely it was. Oh, bless our God, you peoples, make the voice of his praise to be heard, who keeps our soul among the living and does not allow our feet to be moved. For you, O God, have tested us. You have refined us as silver is refined. I don't know a lot about how they do this stuff, but I'm pretty sure they heat it up pretty good. And that's the picture here. You've allowed us to be refined as silver is refined. Listen to Zechariah 13:7. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who is my companion, says the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. That'll sound familiar to you who are students of the Gospels, who remember Jesus said this was going to happen. This is the place he was quoting from. Then he says, I'll turn my hand against the little ones. It shall come to pass in all the land, says the Lord. 2/3 of it shall be cut off and die, but 1/3 shall be left in it. And I will bring the 1/3 through the fire. We'll refine them as silver is refined and test them as gold is tested. And they will call upon my name and I will answer them and I will say, this is my people. And each one will say, the Lord is my God. Peter says in 1 Peter 4, and it's the last I have for you, beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may be glad with exceeding joy. What this tells us is that trials can come from the enemy. The Lord can bring them so that we can be refined and so we can show that we trust him and believe in him. That's exactly what was taking place here. God was allowing in their situation Nebuchadnezzar to cast him into the fiery furnace. But take note, verse 26. Nebuchadnezzar goes near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps, administrators, governors, king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected. The smell of fire was not on them. And Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants. And that word angel means messenger. He doesn't know it's the Lord. How could he? But he does know they were delivered by the power of God. And he trusted in him, or they trusted in him, and have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies so they should not serve nor worship any god. And note, it's a small g, except their own God, and it's a capital G. Nebuchadnezzar blesses the true and living God, and then he testifies to the faithfulness of the three witnesses. I'd suggest to you, when we find ourselves in the midst of a fiery trial, this is God's intention, that he will refine us, purify us in the process, that he will, through that test, produce a testimony. And not only will we testify to his greatness, his faithfulness, but those who look on will end up testifying that we do serve and worship the true and living God. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, he's still not all there, but he makes a decree. And he goes a bit overboard. People do that when they have all power. We can be grateful we don't. But he makes a decree that any people, nation, or tongue which speaks anything amidst the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut to pieces. I think that's going overboard. You see, here's a guy who had rebelled against God, who had revealed the future to him. He had stood up and said, I'm not going to submit to the reality that you've presented. I'm going to deny it in this golden, glorious image. And now that he's convinced that, well, that God is the true and living God, he's saying it'll be a capital crime if you even say anything against him. You see, it's like radical wrong and radical wrong. Because this isn't how you bring people to faith in the Lord. Okay, and you say anything bad against this God, you'll be cut to pieces. Houses made an ash heap. But he does have this right. There is no other God who can deliver like this. And the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.